if you can go all the way, for instance, to Bangladesh to make a shirt and can make it for 20 cents and ship it for another 20 cents and sell it for $10, you can make more money than you can if you make it in Mississippi, even paying someone the minimum wage in the United States. That's raw business. Now, how do we address that?
How the labor movement survives in a global economy on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Trade unions, both in the U.S. and around the world, are facing enormous hurdles as they try to carry out their mission in a new and ever-changing global marketplace. Freer international trade may mean increased sales because goods can travel across national boundaries, but it also means that capital and other resources, the means of production, can also cross boundaries, sometimes in search of cheap labor. Here to discuss the labor movement's response to these developments are Michelle Briones, International Relations Director of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and Jeffrey Fiedler, Secretary Treasurer of the Food and Allied Services Department of the AFL-CIO. First, Michelle Briones describes her work.
The International Ladies Garment Workers Union is actively engaged in world affairs because it believes that strengths lie in workers' solidarity, not only in the workplace, also in a nation, and in the world, as a matter of fact. Today, we live, and it sounds almost like a cliche, but we live in a very interdependent economic world, a global village, economic village. Capital is moving. Banking is moving. So the labor movement maybe has also to become more and more international. It is nothing new to the international labor, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. We have always believed in solidarity. For many decades, the ILGWU, my union, has had a Department of International Affairs. We have always responded to arrest or jailing of trade unionists around the world. We have protested. We came to many instances to help strikers in other countries. We ask our government to put pressure on, you know, other government so that whenever workers' rights are violated. So that's one aspect of workers' solidarity. But today, when what I was saying, when the capital, when companies are moving, and we saw some instances, do not forget that the LGW represent a labor-intensive industry, which is, of course, easily, you know, it's not a capital-intensive, it is easy to move. We saw some instances that company have moved over weekends, leaving one country, leaving also the workers without paycheck. So capital, as I say, is moving very rapidly. So we have to have contact with unions from throughout the world. And we do that. We have programs of assistance with the unions, democratic unions, in many countries of the world. We also more and more look at how could we organize globally, because what happens, many companies go supposedly to help the economic development of some countries. They go and start a company, which no doubt create employment, but under certain conditions, and sometimes the condition that there is no trade unions and that workers' rights are violated. So we have, whenever you see, they say that it's for the good of the people, the workers in other country, but we do not believe that. We know that's only because they are in search of the cheapest possible labor force. You know, as a matter of fact, as soon as workers try to organize, and especially we have a problem with what we call the free trade zone, as soon as they start to organize, they're threatening to move away from the countries and to go and install their companies.
The companies are threatening.
The companies are threatening. So we have to see how we can help helping those workers, and especially in our industry, in the free trade zone, like in the Central America or in the Maquilas, also in Mexico. How can we help in organizing? How can we follow in one way that they do, the companies, wherever they move, we're going to be behind. And for that, we need some contact with union from throughout the world.
Well, there are a number of issues in there that I want to go back and talk about. Let's first bring in Jeffrey Fiedler and have him describe the international aspect of what he does for the AFL-CIO.
Well, first let me explain a little bit the difference. Michelle represents a single union. My department represents 16 different unions, 3.5 million people in the food and allied service trades sector. In food, hotels, bakeries, multinationals dominate those businesses in the United States. So no longer are we dealing with American companies only. And then we're also dealing with the situation of American companies moving overseas, destroying our jobs in this constant search for cheap labor. So we can't ignore what goes on in the world. Myself, I've been spending a great deal of my time in the last couple of years focused on Asia and on China and on the issue of forced labor in China and the export of forced labor products. We've been working on and assisting in investigating the Chinese gulag and its relationship with imports into the United States, which is a sort of human rights and principled issue. It also affects jobs in that, for instance, shoes made in China may be made in a prison. There are shoe workers in the United States, in Missouri, Tennessee, who are regularly losing their jobs. It is impossible to compete with slave labor, which raises the question of the American labor movement's general participation in international affairs. There is our own worker concerns and our own concerns about helping workers around the world increase their own well-being. We happen to believe it is not only in their interest, but it is in our own interest. We must compete in a world, in a larger world, but we don't feel that it's at all right to compete, for instance, in her industry with 5 cents an hour children working in Bangladesh making shirts, selling them to the large discounters in the United States at the cost of American jobs. And the impact of such things as child labor in other countries is that not only do you import the products, but you import the conditions. It reduces the conditions in the United States. For instance, in order to compete, producers in the United States feel that they have to lower wages, decrease conditions, make things more difficult, and return to where we were 30, 40 years ago. So exposing conditions around the world, we think, is part of our duty. Also, part of what we recognize is that corporations, American corporations, which are really no longer truly American but are more multinational, know no loyalty to countries. American corporations, in our view, oftentimes, are not particularly interested in the interest of the American people, but are interested in the simple almighty dollar. And therefore, we chase them around the world in concert with our union brothers and sisters to keep them honest wherever they may go. That will probably never change. We'll always have to do that. So, and Michelle had referred earlier to, this is not new, we also have from an American foreign policy, as American citizens, we have an interest in what our government does. And we have always been very strongly anti-communist. We are pro-democratic, not just negative. And so we believe it is important that if democracy is to develop throughout the world, that first and foremost there must exist free and democratic trade unions in those countries. And so we therefore we help to develop those in other countries.
The current Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, wrote a book before he took office, of course, The Work of Nations, in which he said that the whole notion of national economy was outdated. I'd like to know if you agree with that, that the idea of a national economy is outdated, and if so, what are the consequences of that for organized labor?
No, I mean, I last time I looked, we still had a national economy. We'll have a national economy so long as we have national borders. I think what Reich is saying is that the influences on our national economy are increasingly international. And that, to that extent, absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. Michelle?
Yeah, I agree. It's exactly that, that the companies are becoming more and more international, and sometimes even some country, the capital almost dictates what they want. We have cases, for instance, it's not in our industry, but in the electronic industry in Malaysia. A company wanted to move to Malaysia, an electronic company, and I think it's an American company, as a matter of fact. The Malaysia, you know, the electronic workers could not organize in Malaysia, but because of workers' demand, the government at one point had agreed to let the electronic workers to organize. When the multinational was ready to move and to invest, most probably, as they always say, for the good of the people, when they heard that the government of Malaysia had agreed to let workers in the electronic industry organize, they then changed and told the government, if you allow that, then we will meet, we will go and invest in another countries. So I think what they are doing more and more, in one way, the companies, and I think Jeff alluded to this, also they are trying to pit workers of one country against workers of another country because of this continuous competition. They keep threatening that if you don't agree to the term, our terms, then we will go to another country. That's why we need the solidarity among workers.
It seems that in your answers, there is the notion of an oversupply of workers, that there are so many workers that, in effect, it has the effect of pushing down wages overall. If there are an oversupply of workers, and I don't know if you agree with that, how can you possibly fight that effect?
Well, let me address it in a couple of ways. Oversupply in the world is what you're saying?
Yes, globally. Yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. I mean, there are oversupply of workers in certain industries. I mean, there are still industries where skills are required to perform the work, and they don't exist in other places as skilled as the U.S. worker. But labor-intensive industries that are unskilled, companies are simply in a constant move in search of the cheapest labor available, so long as the country has electricity, water, and ships. And the economics of it is that if you can go all the way, for instance, to Bangladesh to make a shirt and can make it for 20 cents and ship it for another 20 cents and sell it for $10, you can make more money than you can if you make it in Mississippi, even paying someone the minimum wage in the United States. That's raw business. Now, how do we address that? We happen to believe that we don't compete with the rest of the world by simply reducing our wages down to 20 cents a day or hour. If that's the case, who's going to be around to afford to buy all this stuff? And the nature of this national economy, which we still have, will be very, very different. And it's our view generally that, unfortunately, that's where we're headed. Often we are accused of being what's called protectionist. And in effect, we're not ever against trade. We're against unfair trade. We don't believe that our government negotiators have negotiated very good deals. For instance, you must admire the Japanese. They're better negotiators vis-a-vis the Americans than our American negotiators have been. And I don't blame the Japanese for that. I blame our own negotiators for that.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with Jeffrey Fiedler of the AFL-CIO and Michelle Briones of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs.
We are not against trade. We are not against the Mexican workers and the Bengali workers to have jobs. On the contrary, we do agree. What we would like to see, it's fair trade. The companies tell us that it's for the good of the American people, for instance, the products will be cheaper. Well, we have made some investigation about that. And some shirts that are being made maybe by workers that make as low as 13 cents, 14 cents an hour, like in Bangladesh, when they come back here, the prices are almost the same as if they had been made by workers that will make $6 or $7. Also, what I go back, when we ask for workers' right, we tell us, as Jeff have said also, oh, you come now because it's because of some sort of protectionism. We are not. We do not ask also that the workers maybe in Bangladesh or in Thailand make as much as the American workers. But one thing we would like, a couple of things we would like. First, that they can have workers' right, that they are allowed to form trade union, that they that they respect the basic, what we call International Labor Organization workers' right. That's what we are demanding. We know that the Thai workers will not go and make $6 or $7 an hour. But we would like them to make a decent wages that allow them, that permit them also to have a decent life. Like we see in the free trade zone, I go back to the free trade zone in Guatemala, in the Dominican Republic. Those workers make, and mainly in our industry, they are young women, because even according to the employer themselves, they said that they are more flexible and they can be easily threatened. But what the wages they make do not allow them to have proper housing and even proper food for their family. So that's what we are asking also, that at least they get proper wages.
So what is the international mechanism then that can guarantee that? I mean, I understand Mr. Fiedler saying that you know, the answer is not bring American wages down to 20 cents, obviously. And instead, we need to have fair trade. We need people to be paid fair wages so that they can have decent housing. Is there an international mechanism then that enforces that or brings that about?
No.
Okay. Then how do we do it?
How do we do it even in the United States? We do it through struggle, and we do it through laws. For instance, give you an example. In U.S. trade law, there's a system called the General Systematized Preference, System of Preferences. Certain products come in. It's called GSP. Some years ago, we were instrumental in getting included in that law certain basic worker rights provisions. that if a country did not live up to those provisions, it could therefore not receive preferential treatment by the United States in the importation of those products. I don't know how successful that's been. I would argue with you that workers are on a constant uphill struggle. That has always been true in history. That what we do is try to cooperate with each other. I mean, for instance, if there was a big fight, as there was some years ago in a Coca-Cola Guatemala plant where workers were being killed, an international campaign was undertaken to put pressure on Coke to make things right. But these are relatively isolated instances. I would argue right now that business is having its way in country after country after country.
If I could just add what Jeff said about the GSP, and if it had been successful, I think it has been sort of successful in many cases. I mean, that helps to improve, I think, workers' rights. One case is when, under Pinochet, when the labor movement filed a petition to deny the GSP treatment status to Chile. And it was finally, because it's a long procedure, you know, it has first to be accepted for review, and then first to be accepted, and then they review it, and they deny it or not, or they extend for a certain period. But when finally Chile had been denied the GSP treatment, it's not long after that Pinochet released the leader of the labor movement that had been again sent for some 400 days in exile in the north of Chile, just because he had led a demonstration on the street for nothing else. And one of our conditions was to free the labor leaders and to respect workers' rights, and he did release them. Not long ago, the AFL-CIO and other organizations filed another petition against the Dominican Republic and against Guatemala, and it has been instrumental also to lead to some kind of labor reform. So I think it is sort of, not always successful, but it's the first step, I think.
One aspect of the pressures that have to be brought on companies.
All right. Do you want to expand on that any, on the pressures?
Other pressures?
Yeah.
We have to bring pressures on companies in all sorts of different ways, on the street, through boycotts, through strikes, through organizing, through lots of normal, traditional struggle that we engage in as trade unions, whether it be in the United States, Poland, Chile, Dominican Republic, elsewhere. It happens, by the way, to be dangerous to your life in most other countries. In the United States, it is also dangerous, perhaps dangerous to your job, not to your life as often.
I want to close with this question. Labor, organized labor in this country has had a strong democratic tradition, strong democratic ideals, and the Clinton administration's sort of newly formulated foreign policy that has been termed enlargement is supposed to expand the number of free market economies, free market democracies around the world. Is that the kind of rationale, focus for U.S. foreign policy that you can support? Is that something that the labor movement would be behind?
Well, I think that's a simplified version of what the president said. We're not opposed to free market economic development anywhere in the world. We also don't believe that simple free market capitalism brings democracy to a country. It may bring simple exploitation of the workers in that country. Therefore, it ought to be part of American foreign policy to encourage the development of democratic institutions, among them trade unions. If that is not the policy of our government, no matter if it's Mr. Clinton, Mr. Bush, Mr. Gingrich, anyone, we will stand up and fight them for that principle.
All right. Ms. Briones, I'll give you the final word.
Well, I sort of I agree with what Jeff said. You know, we have nothing against a free market economy, but it is the buzzword now around the world, a free market economy. But the free market economy is based also on markets. And I think what we will, you know, if we do not have the protection of workers' rights in the country that expels free market economy, what we're going to create around the world, it's a free market economy without market, because as Jeff has said before, the wages, we want the wages in the less developed world to increase and not the wages in this country to decrease, because who at the end, everybody would like to produce, but who at the end will have the purchasing power to buy the products in a free market economy if we do not have any market? We see the markets disappearing because the people are losing their jobs, like in the United States. People cannot buy as much as they could before because, like in the textile and the garment industry, for instance, many people cannot buy as many garments as before, for sure, because they lose their job, the wages are reduced, and first they have to feed and be housed. So we are nothing against a free market economy, but workers' rights, internationally recognized workers' rights, the right to join union, the right to have decent wages must be included.
That is Michelle Briones, International Relations Director for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. Our other guest was Jeffrey Fiedler, Secretary Treasurer of the Food and Allied Services Department of the AFL-CIO. I'm Keith Porter. To order a cassette of this Common Ground program on global labor and global economy, please call us at 319-264-1500 or write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa 52761. Ask for program number 9403. That's program number 9403. Again, the phone number, 319-264-1500. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.